They're all of one mind, I'm sure. Just like students are of one mind. Someplace I've got your exam, because I wasn't sure you pick them up from your mailbox, but I think I want to find it after class. You did fine. Questions? B greater than R.
The distance greater than.
To find the magnetic field for at large distances.
Right. Yes. How would one? If we get this disgusting integral, how would we kind of? We get something like R minus D cosine theta. Would we just assume that it would just go to negative D, larger than D?
Negative D. So I think the problem you're talking about is the loop in the plane. Is that true?
Yes.
And I asked you, like, what's the approximation for the magnetic field at the center and right next to the coil and far away? And for all of those, maybe for the center, I might bother to do an integral. But for the rest of them, the idea is to find a physical situation that kind of matches. And you remember we showed the multipole expansion that says that for any current, we can approximate it as a magnetic dipole if we're far enough away from it. So that would be the plan, to approximate that current loop as a magnetic dipole. Well, I'm sure you can do the integral, because if you're at large distances, the integral is just going to give you the multipole expansion. But we did that, right? We expanded that integral. So just using the multipole expansion should be fast. So for right next to the wire, how do we work that one? Say again? So the graph shows that the magnetic field is going to infinity near that wire, right? And kind of what's a standard formula for a magnetic field from a wire? Yeah. So if you're very close to that wire, even though it's not infinite, it's going to look infinite. Because R is so small. And for the origin, there are kind of lots of ways of doing it, but the integral is easy enough because it's 100% contribution, and there's no angle involved. So you basically just get the circumference of the circle times the magnetic field divided by the constant distance, which is R. So it that integral goes pretty quick. More questions?
Do you have a big magnet downstairs?
The real big permanent magnet in the basement? You haven't seen that?
I have.
Okay.
Those rhetorical. Okay, now I have a better question. So, Dr. Bob has told me that one time, that he heard that one time there was a professor that was doing an experiment with I don't know what, the dangerous stuff. And then I don't know what he was doing, but he said that the magnet attracted his watch or something, and he spilled over all this radioactive bad stuff, and it spilled everywhere, and so we're all getting radiation. We're all dying because we're in this building. Am I right or am I right?
I have not, so.
Yeah, it's probably
So I think I can, I think I can guarantee you that Steck didn't do that. But he would be the one to ask, and he certainly made zillions of radiation measurements in the building. And he still walks in every day, so I think...
Well, now we know what time tiring. He kind of walks in. We call that walking.
I think I can be reasonably sure that there isn't any worse stuff in this building than there is in your own house, as Dan would say.
Yeah.
But the history of that magnet... I mean, you know that Bob is probably the oldest guy, oldest prof still on campus. So he goes way back. It could very well be a pre.
No. I was talking to Dr. Bob Hess, not DeMonzo.
Oh no, he doesn't know anything. DeMonzo might know some stories, but I can't believe Bob Hess knows anything that I don't know.
He said he heard that.
Oh right.
No.
Have any good stories about that?
Think about all the other stuff.
I have never heard, so the only reason they have that magnet that I know of is for the fun of trying to get that big piece of steel off of it, which I don't think anyone has done with many decades of trying. So there's a glob of iron that's about like that, a cylinder, that is stuck to that permanent magnet. So I don't know anything about the history of that. That was down in the basement when I came. What is true is that we used to have a neutron generator that used to aim right up into that little seminar room that's next to Sarah's office.
Mm-hmm. I had a lab there.
So undoubtedly some neutron activated analysis has changed the floor composition of that seminar room. But those all have short half-lives, so you're probably safe. Yeah, now it's just psychology. So it doesn't matter. This seems like a delaying tactic to me that succeeded.
Well, we still have an hour to go.
Any real questions? Okay, so we were talking. So what we've been doing is kind of exactly what we're doing with electric fields, except now with magnetic fields. So with electric fields, it isn't true, but roughly speaking, all we did is take the epsilon naught to epsilon, right? That was kind of the effect of the polarized material. And while it isn't true that Gauss's law says that the surface integral of the electric field dotted into the area is the charge divided by epsilon, boy, it kind of seems that it's true. So we don't have such a version of Gauss's law. And in a similar, almost but not true sense, we don't have a Ampere's law that says that all we have to do is replace the mu by the mu naught. But as a knee-jerk reaction, when you have a problem with magnetic material, kind of your first thought should be, I bet it's going to work out with a mu instead of a mu naught. In order to do all of this, of course, we needed to have some sort of connection between the magnetized material and the unmagnetized material. And so boundary conditions, our friend boundary conditions, come into play. And Gauss's law version of the absence of magnetic monopoles, that is to say the fact that the divergence of B is equal to zero, that tells you if you make any old sort of Gaussian, not Amperian, Gaussian surface, the integral of B dot dA has to be zero. And if we make such a Gaussian pillbox, we usually call them, at the boundary of two media, we can quickly come to the conclusion that there's no change in the normal component of B. Okay? And similarly, if we look at the tangential components of H and use the real version of Ampere's law, right? So our new improved version of Ampere's law says that the loop integral of H dot dl is equal to the free current. So if we make a little Amperean loop like this, the only way there's going to be current in this very thin loop is if there is surface current flowing. And so the discontinuity in the tangential component of H perpendicular to that flowing current turns out to be given by that surface current that's flowing. Real commonly, there's no free surface current, and so there's no change in the tangential component of H, and that's exactly the way it was with the electric field, right? So then we have it, of course, then we have it kind of set up similar to what we would have with the electric fields. We had no change in the normal component of D if there was no free charge, surface charge on the surface, and we had no change in the tangential component of the electric field, period. Okay, so not uncommonly we have things like permanent magnets where there's no free currents whatsoever, and under these circumstances the curl of H is going to be zero, which means that we can write H as the gradient of something. And what we have then is the divergence of H is going to be given by the divergence of the magnetization, the so-called pole density. And commonly that's going to be zero because magnetization is connected to H, is connected to B, and the divergence of B is going to be zero. Okay, so it might be worth kind of reminding you how that all works. For the electric field case, you might remember that that under the linear dielectric sort of situation, the bound charge density was proportional to the free charge density. And so when we were in material that had no free charge density, there was no bound charge density, and so we could still satisfy Laplace's equation. In terms of magnetization, the bound currents are going to be the curl of M, and the curl of M is chi times the curl of H, and H is 1 over mu times B. So if we have linear material so we can pull all of those out, well, actually, let's not take it to B. Let's leave it at H. So then we have chi times the free current density. So this is the magnetization current density, and this is the free current density. They're just multiples of each other. So absent free currents, there isn't going to be magnetization currents. Okay, so that brings up the possibility of doing Laplace one more time. And so we did Laplace in a variety of sorts of circumstances. We did the uniformly magnetized sphere, and there are a couple of ways of thinking about the sphere. If we think about it in terms of its pole density, then here we have our uniformly magnetized sphere. We're going to have positive poles on this end and negative poles on that end. So we're expecting that the H field is going to go from plus to minus, and we're going to get a dipole field on the outside. Or if you want, you can think about it in terms of currents, because we know that M cross N hat is a surface current that's flowing. And so this thing is kind of like a spherical solenoid. There's a surface current that's flowing on the surface. So again, these things are going to make a dipole field on the outside and a upward going magnetic field on the inside. So upward B on the inside, downward H on the inside. That's all consistent with a magnetization that is up. Right, because U naught H plus M is equal to B. So in the particular case we've been talking about, this guy was up, this guy was down a little bit, and this guy was up a lot. So we got that sort of relationship. Okay, so what we found in fact is inside the sphere, the H field was down and had a third of the strength of M. And the B field was up, and aside from this factor of mu naught, had a strength that was 2/3 of M. We did the kind of standardized problem of linear magnetic material in a constant magnetic field, and what we found is that the B field likes to be in the material. Magnetized material will suck in some of that B field because the B likes to be in that material. And we commented, and I gave you a big handout on what's kind of a technological importance of this game. If you make a surround that is made out of high mu material, magnetic dielectric constant a lot bigger than one, then it's going to reduce the magnetic inside of that surround by, roughly speaking, that sort of factor. So as long as it's sufficiently thick, you can get a reduction in magnetic fields that are thousands or millions, depending upon what sort of material you're using. We talked about magnetic flux. So magnetic flux isn't going to seem to play a real big role, but if we have a surface, all we're going to do is to dot the magnetic field into the area vector and then add that up for the whole series to get what the magnetic flux was. And we had flux tubes. So those are tubes that have a cylindrical outer surface that is parallel to the magnetic field at that location. So that B dot N is going to be zero on the cylindrical surface of that tube, and therefore there's going to be no flux through that tube, and so the flux going in has to equal the flux going out. So you can think about this as kind of like flow lines, right? So if you had a fluid that is flowing, you can make a surface that is parallel to the flow at every point, and then whatever is flowing into that tube has to be what's flowing out of that tube. Basically, by definition. A useful analogy was to think about the relationship between the J vector, the current density, and the electric field. They're linearly related by the conductivity, and the divergence of J is zero for steady flowing current. And the relationship between the H field and the B field, also linear, and the divergence of B is zero under all circumstances. So if you can kind of think about how the current would flow in an electric field, you can often think about how the B field is going to be in a region of various magnetic material. And that was kind of the argument for what's going on in this technology. If we had copper and seawater, electrical current is going to want to go through the copper, not the seawater. And so the magnetic field is going to be inside the material as opposed to inside whatever the surround is surrounding. Now, what's true is that while the ratio of a magnetized to unmagnetized material can be thousands or maybe even millions, for conductivity, you can have much bigger ratios of 10 to the 30th between the conductivity of glass and the conductivity of copper. So the fact that electricity wants to go through conductors is more pronounced than the fact that B fields want to be inside magnetic material. Questions? So all the sorts of problems we had with dielectrics, we can now do with magnetic material, just to make them more interesting. So what we started to talk about was magnetic circuits. And you guys probably were around when the big magnet was still here, right? Yes, you remember the big magnet? No. Was it already gone? Yeah, so it was in Todd's room. So it was the size of a dumpster. No, so Todd took it out. We sold the copper to buy Todd's stuff, actually. Yeah, it was before anything was in there. It came out in Todd's first summer.
Maybe that's why I don't remember it.
It was my room. I don't know. I won't comment. So typically, big electromagnets are, of course, have to have an experimental area where you can put something in, a gap, but generally speaking are going to be made out of iron with, of course, lots of turns around them. And kind of the question is, how can we calculate what the magnetic field is going to be in the gap in these sorts of circumstances? And a not uncommon situation, it was actually the situation with that big electromagnet, is that you have something like this, where you have turns on both of these ends and the gap is kind of like that. Okay, so how do we proceed on this sort of situation? Well, the fact that I'm talking about a circuit should make you think of V equals IR, something that's analogous to that. And we've got everything we need in order to make that analogy work. The magnetic field, we've said, wants to stay in the iron. Now, this iron might have thin sections, it might have, I don't know why you would ever construct your magnet with such a constriction, but the magnetic field will, to a good extent, try and stay in that iron. And what that means is that the flux is going to be a constant. So roughly speaking, like kind of 200 talk, the magnetic flux is really the integral of B dot dA for any of these surfaces that are transecting this piece of iron. But approximately speaking, this flux is the magnetic field times the area times the cosine of the angle between the area vector and the magnetic field. And since we're going to take our surfaces transverse to the magnetic field, the cosine of 90 degrees is 1. So close enough, this flux is just the magnetic field times the area. So kind of automatically, what we're going to get is a big B field inside this constriction just because the area is smaller, right? Because we said that the flux, any place you calculate it in a flux loop, has to be the same. A little bit louder? No, cosine of 90 degrees is 1. Oh, thank you. 0 is the angle I've got. So what I have is a normal that's like this and a magnetic field's like that. So, yes, the cosine of 90 degrees is 1, and it shouldn't have any relevance to this problem. This is still 1. Okay? Okay, so if we make a Ampurian loop through our magnet, kind of like this, what we know is that the integral around that loop of H dot dl has to be the free current that's penetrating that loop. And all of these turns are going through the inside of that loop at some point, and so what we're going to get is n times the current that's actually flowing through those wires. So this is the free current, in contrast to the magnetization current that is made out of the little atoms that are in the iron. And we know that the H field is the B field divided by mu. And what we've just said is we can get the B field by taking the flux and dividing it by the area. And the flux is going to be a constant as we go around this loop. So what we've got then is the flux is going to be the integral of dl mu area, and that has to equal ni. Okay, so the flux is something that's constant in a series circuit. This is going to be like current. The thing that's forcing this thing is these turns that are around that magnet. This is kind of like the voltage. And so this quantity here, that's kind of like the resistance.
Is that AL?
Deal. So we want to have a word for this that is kind of like resistance, but isn't exactly resistance, and what we call it is the reluctance. And if we had, and I guess we do have, pieces of magnetic circuits like this, where we have, so the book is typically talking about toruses, but there's no special, toruses are just easy to draw. So we might have one set of magnetic material, another set of magnetic material, all sorts of different magnetic material, in addition to these turns that are going around the object, right? So this one here might be material one, and this one here might be material two, and so it goes. And what we have is that loop integral as we go around the circuit. So if we do that, we've got the loop integral. That's too, not a good pen. How about purple? So what we've got is a loop integral of dl divided by mu times a, and we can break that up into the corresponding pieces, right? Each one of these pieces has some length, and it has some mu, and it has some cross-sectional area. And so this is just the usual story that the resistance in a series circuit is just the sum of the resistances in that circuit. So we can just add up the reluctances of each one of those pieces. Okay, so usually you don't bother to make your magnet out of lots of different pieces. Typically, a magnet would have, you know, just one sort of material. It might have several different areas just according to how much material is available. And for reasons that I hope I get around to describe, typically where the gap is, there are what are called pole pieces, which have a shape kind of like I've shown. So in this sort of simple situation, we have one reluctance from all of this stuff. And if this thing had constant cross-sectional area, that reluctance would just be the length of the circuit divided by mu times the cross-sectional area. And we would also have a reluctance from the gap, which would be the thickness of the gap, typically small, mu naught, because we're in air, and the cross-sectional area of the gap. Okay, so then we'd have the equation that the thing that's like voltage, Ni, is equal to the reluctance of the material plus the reluctance of the gap times the flux. Oh, that was a picture of what these pole pieces look like.
I mean, on the numerator.
That's a delta. So I'm calling this distance between the gap delta, and I'm choosing a letter that kind of implies it's small compared to everything else.
Does it matter where the delta is measured? Because if it's pole pieces, it looks like they're different
delta. Yeah. So this whole thing is going to be a little bit hand wavy. What is, you know, kind of plus or minus 10%-ish, what is the gap given that I have that sort of picture? And what is the area of the gap given that I have this picture? And maybe now is as good a time to talk about what the purpose of the pole pieces is. The purpose of the pole piece is to try and keep the area of the gap as small as possible. The magnetic field has no reason to want to go through this air, and it will try and bow out And the purpose of these pole pieces is to try and keep the magnetic field going through as small a cross-sectional area as possible, because that's going to make the resistance, the reluctance, as small as possible, and it's going to give you as big a flux as you can get. So we're trying to make the reluctance of the gap as small as possible, because it usually dominates. Right? So remember that the mu of these magnetic materials can be 1,000 or 1,000,000 times what the magnetic field is of the gap. So even though the gap is small, not uncommonly, this is going to be the primary reluctance. Yeah, so there's also an area in here. So you'll see in a second that in this limit it's going to is going to be helpful to make that small. So let's deal with that case where the reluctance of the gap is a lot bigger than the reluctance of the rest of the iron. So then we've got Ni is equal to the reluctance of just the gap, which is delta over mu naught A. And then we've got the flux, which is, roughly speaking, the magnetic field times that same A. So those things go away, and what we get then is the magnetic field in the gap is mu naught N divided by delta times I. And you might compare that to the formula that we had for an infinite solenoid, right? So for an infinite solenoid, the magnetic field was mu naught, the number of turns per length, times I. So basically what this iron is doing is it's sometimes called a flux return for this reason. It's making sure that however much flux leaves the top of this pole piece comes back around an equal amount here. And so kind of what the equations think is that it's an infinite solenoid with all of the turns concentrated just in that gap. Okay, and obviously we can't literally put, I mean, in a typical electromagnet, these turns would be way thick. There'd be thousands of them, and you can't literally put that many turns in that small region. Okay, so there are lots of things that are kind of plus or minus 10 or 20%-ish about all of these sorts of calculations. The magnetic field won't fully stay in the iron. There'll be some flux leakage. Exactly where do you take this L, right? Do I take it as the extreme outer value, or do I take it as small as possible? What's the area of the gap? What's the delta of the gap? So none of these things are precise, but they're usually good enough to design your electromagnetic system, because of course if you don't get exactly what you want, you can just increase your current by 10% to get what you want. Okay. So those are kind of classic electromagnets. Maybe it's worth commenting that for that big electromagnet, which none of you remember, one of the big problems is cooling. So this thing was hooked up to a water supply in order to keep it from melting. Water was continually flowing through the magnet. So when it was operating at full power, it was drawing about as much electricity as a house would. So it was using its own three-phase power supply. So big magnets demand big currents.
Do you have a picture of it? Now I'm just really intrigued. It's the size of a dumpster.
Yeah. Who's the size of a dumpster?
I think that office is the size of a dumpster.
Todd's area? No, so Todd's area is a third the size of this room.
How did you get it into?
It barely fits. The real question is how, so it also weighs multi-tons. So the real question is how it was moved. And it was moved with a special forklift to lift it up and move it. And it just barely fits inside the. So these things are designed to, it's a piece of physics equipment, and they're designed to go through doors.
Barely.
Yep. It didn't have to go in an elevator.
What?
It didn't have to go in the elevator. I don't know if it could have gone in the elevator or not.
Oh yeah, there's no way it would work weight-wise.
I have pictures of it being taken apart. I should.
Yeah, what about the ramp over there?
So it came in this from the dock. It's out there.
What about auditorium?
What?
Isn't there?
No, the ramp down there. It's no wonder you guys. No wonder you guys never saw the magnet. Okay, so this is a classic permanent magnet. And this thing, which with work I can get out, is usually called a keeper. Ow. And these are...
No.
I don't want to hurt myself.
We don't want you to hurt yourself either.
There. So how does this permanent magnet work? What's the story on it? And how could we design a permanent magnet to get a particular magnetic field in the gap? So what we've got here is a permanent magnet that's in the base, and then we've got these kind of arms that come up. And we can run pretty much the same argument that we've been running, right? So we can make a loop and we can calculate what the integral of H dot dl is, and it better equal zero because there are no turns on this loop. So we want to separate this out into the piece that goes through the permanent magnet. And the rest. And the rest, we can use what we've done. It's going to be the flux times the reluctance. And I guess we might as well write this stuff on the other side of the equation and bring some things together. So the flux is, of course, the magnetic field times the area, but which area and which magnetic field? And we can calculate the flux any place because the flux should be the same any place along this flux tube. So I'm going to choose, so even though this term has to do with the magnetic field outside of the permanent magnet, I'm going to choose to evaluate the flux inside the permanent magnet. So this is going to be B inside the permanent magnet times the area of the permanent magnet.
So it has to do with outside the permanent magnet, that term?
Yeah, so
Could it be in the arms or whatever?
So theoretically, you could calculate the flux any place.
So by
permanent magnet, I mean permanent magnet material, special material that's able to hold its magnetic field. These arms are just made out of iron. So the permanent magnet is there at the base. In some sense, these arms are just bigger versions of this keeper. Okay, so if I rearrange this equation a little bit, what I get is that the B field, which I usually just call the magnetic field, inside the magnet is minus the length of the permanent magnet divided by the area of the permanent magnet times the H of the permanent magnet. I don't know, the minus sign might bother you a little bit. Wait, I've dropped my reluctance too, right? So the reluctance also wants to be with the area. Yeah, I guess I'm happy with all of that. So usually we think of the H field and the B field being in the same direction, but here we see they're in opposite directions. And I remind you that we saw that before when we were looking at the permanently magnetized sphere, right? They were in opposite directions there. And if we hearken back to our hysteresis curves, you remember we said that these are typically plots of the H field versus the B field. And if we start with an unmagnetized piece of material, as we increase the H field, we get hugely more B field because we're getting the current we supply in H is being multiplied by the magnetic susceptibility in all of those atomic currents. And then if we reduce the magnetic field reverses eventually and it comes back kind of like there, right? So we have these sorts of hysteresis loops that we talked about before. And what we're going to be focusing on is this piece, this backwards piece, where the magnetic field and the H field have different signs. So here is a plot from your book of exactly this sort of situation for various types of magnetic material. So I note that although the book comments there in the figure caption, what's listed as B is actually H. And it's being multiplied by mu naught so that we get the same units for both the X and the Y axis, namely Tesla. So what we need to do then is to find a value that satisfies this hysteresis curve and satisfies this equation here. So this is a linear relationship with a negative slope. So roughly speaking, if we were to plot this equation on this graph, it's going to look kind of like this. And where the magnet is going to be there, it has to satisfy both of those equations. So the permanent magnet is going to be at that intersection spot. So if you look at this graph, you'll see a couple of lines that I drew to solve some problems that indicate exactly this sort of situation. Okay, so what's the point of the so-called keeper? So what we've said is not uncommonly, the reluctance is being dominated by the gap. And so the reluctance is going to be delta over mu naught times the area of the gap. And so by filling this gap with magnetic material, I'm going to make a huge reduction to this reluctance. So as this reluctance gets smaller in the denominator, that means that this slope is going to get more and more close to infinity. Right? Smaller number in the denominator, bigger slope. So I'm going to have less demagnetizing effect on that permanent magnet material. There's going to be a smaller backwards going H. And so that's the reason for the keeper. It reduces the demagnetizing field by reducing the reluctance of the magnetic circuit. Okay, questions? So you should have a handout. Looks kind of like this. So this is actually from a 200 book, so should be able to work it. We'll work, one of the problems you're working is to figure out how this, these things are often called yokes, how the bottom yoke works to provide a magnetic field in the gap. And what we're supposed to do is to read off as best we can, values of the magnetization of these various types of material. And I think this is material F, isn't it? Or I guess it's E, pure iron sheet. you might notice that these things, that this is a log-log plot, and these solid lines are giving you what the appropriate mu is. So you can see that for A, which is, I guess, oh, it's super permalloy, mu is about a million, and it kind of goes down from there to just hundreds. Questions? So I'm having you read chapter 10, but I'm not going to say much more about chapter 10 than I have already. And kind of a brief reminder of that, we talked about various types of magnetic material, diamagnetic material. These are cases where chi is negative. And the story here was that if we think about the orbiting electrons, if you apply a magnetic field, they actually slow down to produce a magnetic dipole moment that's oriented in the opposite direction of the applied magnetic field. Okay? Most materials are diamagnetic. But chi is, generally speaking, on the order of minus a 10,000th or something like that. It's usually not particularly significant. We've got paramagnetic materials. So paramagnetic materials are materials where the individual atoms do have a magnetic dipole moment. And if the temperature is low enough, that magnetic dipole moment will be aligned with the magnetic field. And so this produces chis that are greater than zero. For typical sort of temperatures and situations, the chi is still, though, on order 10 to the minus fourth. So still basically no effect from paramagnetic materials. And then we've got ferromagnetic materials, which are things like iron, which have all of these kind of nasty behaviors, right? They're nonlinear, they have hysteresis. They die at a certain temperature called the Curie temperature. They have domain structure where we have 100% alignment of a micron-sized piece of the material. Now, one thing we didn't talk about before was ferrites. And you see ferrites increasingly these days. I think if you look at your charger for your cell phone or something like that, there'll be this big cylinder that is sitting off of that wire. That's a ferrite. And the claim to fame of ferrites is that, I guess I'll say what they are in a second, they have moderately big chi, not as big as ferromagnetic materials, but they have relatively low conductivity. So they have a noticeable amount of magnetic effect, but without the electrical conductivity that would go along with iron or cobalt or any of the other sort of materials. They're typically iron oxides. So maybe before I'll talk about ferrites, let me talk about antiferromagnets. So for ferromagnets, you remember the rules of quantum mechanics require all of these dipole moments to be aligned, basically at any old sort of temperature. With antiferromagnets, it turns out that quantum mechanics requires them to be exactly anti-aligned. So as we march through the material, the dipole moments are pointed in an opposite direction. So of course they don't have a big chi, but they have all of the other properties that go along with ferromagnetic materials. So they would have a Curie temperature, they would have domain structure, all of that sort of stuff. So the area called solid state physics or condensed matter physics is explaining why quantum mechanics leads to these sorts of materials. So ferrites are typically a type of antiferromagnetic material, but one where the downward arrows are not as big as the upward arrows. So they have noticeable amounts of chi, and it turns out from their structure, basically because they're oxides, They're not electric. They're not very good electrical conductors, and that combination of pretty good chi and small conductivity means that they are very useful for blocking high frequencies. So the purpose of this blob on your charging wire is to block any high frequencies that might be coming from the computer in your cell phone, or they might be coming from general radio interference from working its way back into the electrical circuit. Have you all noticed these things or not? They're increasingly present because FCC is trying to limit radio transmissions from computers. So there's one missing piece compared to what we did with electric fields, and I mention it only to dismiss it. So if you remember what we did with electric fields, if we were pretty concerned about the difference between the electric field that we'd been calculating and the electric field that an individual molecule has. And the plan was that we took our dielectric material and we carved out a hole in that dielectric material, and we subtracted the electric field that this dielectric material had from this sphere, and then we added back in the electric field from all of the dipoles that made up that hunk of electrical material. So it's basically, we treated this sphere as continuous in calculating the value of E, and then what we're going to do is to subtract off this the effect of this sphere, and then add in all of the individual dipoles, the electric field due to all of these various dipoles. And typically what we did is we hoped that sum of dipoles was going to be zero, either because they were randomly arrayed or then they were in a cubic structure. In general, that quantity won't be zero. It's not zero in lots of crystalline structures, but it happens to be zero in cubic structures. Well, so we could do exactly the same thing with magnetic fields, right? Because we know what sort of magnetic field is produced by a uniformly magnetized sphere, right? So the magnetic field that we get from a magnetized sphere was 2/3 mu naught M. So we could add that in and subtract it back and make a distinguishing characteristic between the magnetic field that we've been calculating and the magnetic field that an individual molecule is going to experience. So the reason that this is not really worth doing is because there are two situations, right? There's the situation that we normally encounter where chi is on the order of 10 to the minus 4th. So that means that there's basically no magnetization, and the magnetic field is the magnetic field that the molecule is going to experience. And then there's the case of ferromagnetic materials, but they're nonlinear. So you really can't play that game. So when magnetization is important is also when the linearization game doesn't work. So there's really, well, so for completeness sake, this is in your textbooks, but it's not something that's of practical significance, I guess I would say. Because typically chi is either small or we have nonlinear material and then all bets are off. Questions about the rest of static magnetic fields? Okay, so if you think back to 200, right, you started with Coulomb and you wrote down its laws, and then you did Biot-Savart. Right, that's our formula for what the magnetic field is in terms of I dl cross r minus r prime cubed. What comes next? Oh, know, Maxwell. So these, so I'm not, Coulomb I'm pretty sure is pre-1800 and Biot-Savart I think is circa 1820. And Maxwell isn't until 1860. So we've got some dead physicists in that 40 years. Who is that? I don't remember that. The current lab manual has Bohr. The 106 manual has Bohr. Oh, did you have that nice plaid? All the nice ones I made. So that's Maxwell. Maxwell was a Scot. So if you had a nice red plaid on your lab manual, that was because that was Maxwell's plaid.
Oh, you made this one. I was thinking the collage of all of them, and one day he literally went through and picked out all of them. He said, "Here's another famous dead physicist."
Oh, you're talking about our 370 manual.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all modern physics. Pre, post 1900. We're never going to get up to 1900 in this class. That's the next class, quantum mechanics. Say again? Faraday's in here. Any good American dead physicists to pair with Faraday? Dead physicists. Not just seemingly dead physicists. Nearly dead physicists. Physicists with dead cats.
There are a lot of them.
Henry, right?
Henry?
My friend Henry. I remember Henry. Right, so what are these names, what is associated with these guys' names? Induction, yeah. Chapter 11. And along with induction is your friend Lenz, right?
Not your friend.
Lenz's law? So lots of, not next time, but the time after that, you'll have lots of nice assignments with Lenz's law sorts of problems, which you must have done in 200. Say again? No, I never watched Lost. No. Is there stuff about induction and Lost? It has a crazy ending, doesn't it? That's all I remember about it. So Faraday's kind of an interesting character. He really was an experimentalist. So he, as opposed to a theorist, so he discovered a lot of these phenomena, but he really didn't come up with any equations that that described exactly what was going on. He had kind of his own indescribable way of understanding what was happening. And so Maxwell is the guy who put everything together with some neat mathematics and some new physics to figure out how it all worked. And I guess one of the things I would like to know, so it was something like 1890, before Maxwell's equations were verified by who besides Hertz, the guy who rents the cars. And I guess I don't know what the status of Maxwell was in this, you know, 30-year period, whether people believed, recognized his immediate genius or whether they didn't. There are lots of similar situations where on the order of 30-year gaps, even today, 30-year gaps between when theory is proposed and when experiment finally verifies it. And I can tell you by direct experience, only the right theories are remembered, not all of the wrong ones. So to give you kind of a particular example that's kind of in the news, so I think 1967, that's when Weinberg had his theory of weak interactions that made extensive use of Higgs boson. And this theory was totally ignored, since this was my time period, until 1976, when quarks, well, when the charmed quark was discovered. And of course now, with the discovery of Higgs, it's a big yawn, right? Because it's been obvious since 1976 that there had to be something like that around. Yeah, so I really mean that literally. So a colleague was very excited to give me the article in Science that described the so-called finding of the Higgs boson, and you know, it was a big yawn. I've been really confident that it was there for 30 years, so no big surprise. But I would like to know whether people trusted Maxwell in this 30 years or not. There are good reasons to suspect that they didn't. British, particularly Scottish, physicists were not all that high regard. Okay, so what is induction? What's required? Yeah, so people often made the argument that electric fields through voltages made currents and made magnetic fields. So they were, for a long time, looking for ways for magnetic fields to make electric fields. But they were always looking for static sort of situations. And induction, which is exactly where magnetic fields make electric fields, they require a changing magnetic field. So the equation, the way you learned it in 200, is that minus the time derivative of the magnetic flux, you know what that is, that's equal to the, probably was called the EMF, and that's the loop integral of the electric field around some circuit. So let's first talk about the kind of crazy sign conventions. So imagine that I've got a loop kind of like this. And this is in the front, and this is in the back. And there is the rest of the loop is there, but I'm not writing it because I hope it's clear which one is front and back. If I'm going to calculate the flux, what I need is the integral of B dot dA over any old surface that includes that loop. How do I decide what the direction is of these area vectors? Because they're two perfectly good areas, right? If I make this be the surface that I'm integrating over, there's an area vector that is perpendicular that way, and there's an area vector that's perpendicular that way. And I'm going to obviously get the opposite sign depending upon which I choose for flux. So what I have to do is I have to choose an orientation for this loop. So once I've chosen that orientation for this loop, I can use the right-hand rule, and automatically, because I've chosen that orientation for the loop, I have to use that normal, the normal that's given by the right-hand rule. Okay? So if this flux is increasing, What that means, of course, is that there's an ever bigger magnetic field in this direction. And what this minus sign says is that there's going to be an electric field then, an EMF, that's pointing in the opposite direction. Well, what if I had chosen the orientation the other way, right? Because it was a totally random choice to begin with. So if I choose this orientation for my flux, I still have the same magnetic field that's increasing this way, but now I've got a normal that's the other way. So that means that the flux is negative and getting more negative. We agree? Yes? No?
Yes.
Yes. So this has a negative slope, so with this negative slope times a positive, I get a positive number, which means that the electric field is in the direction that I've oriented it. Okay, so the choice of orientation is arbitrary, but the electric field has to be pointing this way or that way, and you can see that no matter which way I choose the orientation of that loop, I get that answer. Well, let's write down, well, maybe we better not write down. Yeah, let's write down the consequence of this equation. So what we have is that minus the time derivative of the flux, and the flux is the magnetic field dotted into the area vector. That all has to equal the loop integral of the electric field dot dA. And we can convert this loop integral into an area integral itself, right, by having the curl. And what area I choose, those are totally arbitrary things. So the only way this could equal that is if the time derivative of B equals the curl of E. So heretofore we said that the curl of E was zero, but we didn't have changing situations. We only had static situations. So now we're going to have changing electric fields. Excuse me, now we're going to have changing magnetic fields, which are going to make electric fields which have a curl, and therefore we cannot write the electric field as minus the gradient of something. You can't do that if the curl isn't zero. So we're going to need a little bit more to make this work, and it's not that tricky. So you remember your enemy, the magnetic potential. So B is equal to the curl of A. And if I now bring these things to the same side of the equation, what I have is the curl of E plus the time derivative of A. That's equal to zero. So this whole quantity, that can be written as minus the gradient of the voltage. So instead of having electric fields that are gradients of voltage, now the electric field is minus the gradient of phi minus the time derivative of A. Okay, so a new term for the electric field, and obviously this has to do with changing magnetic fields. I don't know, maybe I've got time to, I don't have time, but I'm going to take it anyway, to remind you of Lenz's law. So does anybody remember anything about Lenz's law? So Lenz's law says instead of going through this really complicated story to figure out which way the induced current is, there's a simpler way of doing it. And that's the rule that the induced current will try and fight the change in the magnetic field. So we'll come back to this, but let me give you a first shot of it. So what we said is that the magnetic field started out small and it's growing. So if we want to fight that change, this current wants to make a magnetic field that's down. And notice that if the current is flowing this way, right hand rule it, put your thumb in the direction of the current, it would be making a magnetic field that was down if it was going the way the blue arrow shows, the purple arrow shows. Okay, so we'll come back to Lenz's law. It's a easier way of dealing with this minus sign, which is in the mathematics, but takes a while to deal with, whereas it's faster and cheaper to do it. So, let me... No, it's not. Handouts typically aren't online.